For August 11th, 2016, it's the Lullabot Podcast. It's the Lullabot Podcast, episode 193. It's the live edition.
Live, kind of.
I'm Matt Cleave, a senior developer at Lullabot. With me, as always, we have co-host Mike Herschel. Hey, Mike.
Good evening, Matt. How are you doing?
Good evening, Mike Herschel. Hey, we're together. We're actually face-to-face.
It's so cool.
So for those who don't know, Lullabot is a virtual company. We work wherever we live. We live where we work. We work where we live. And so Mike's now across the country from me. I live in Colorado. Mike's in Florida. So we actually get together a couple times a year and have a Lullabot retreat. That's happening right now.
Yep, we are on the outskirts of Atlanta in the Sarumbee Inn, which is a farm, and it's all fancy and organic and rustic here.
It's absolutely rustic. And we're actually sitting around the table with some people that we work with every day, but we never really get the chance to work with often, at least face-to-face.
Yeah. Yes. I agree.
Yeah. And that's kind of the inspiration of what we're talking about today. So today we're getting some people who are Lullabots and don't necessarily work face to face. So Lullabot is a design strategy and development company that primarily is known for their work in Drupal. And so when you say you're a design strategy and development company, you probably should at least think about the designers every once in a while.
We have a design group?
Yeah, we have a great design group, and they're going to talk with us today. We have the creative director at Lullabot with us
today.
Hey, Jared.
Good to be here.
Hey, Jared Ponchot, the creative director at Lullabot. He's a graduate of the Ringling College of Art and Design. He's worked on the MSNBC project with the Grammys, Sony Pictures, Qualcomm, SpaceX, and many more that we can't talk about. And Jared, this is a home game for you. You're Atlanta, Georgia, right?
Yeah. I live about an hour from where we are right now.
That's pretty cool.
Which in Atlanta, like, is very close.
Atlanta, yeah, because you're in that like 18-lane traffic situation where...
Right. And it's like the largest regional footprint, I think, of almost any metro in the United States, so...
I think you're forgetting Jacksonville.
Yes, Jacksonville is also enormous and has a river that flows north like the Nile, which is amazing.
You don't know this, but I'm an 8th grade Geography B champion, so just don't try to pull that fast stuff on me.
Just let you win now. Yeah.
So, hey, Jared.
I realize that I live north of you.
And you've been on the Lullabot Podcast before, but it's been a while.
Yes. Yeah, it's been a while.
So also along with us, we have a senior UX designer who has lots of experience working with nonprofits and government agencies prior to her joining Lullabot 2 weeks or 2 years ago.
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. Yeah, no. She's worked on Grammys and SpaceX, Lullabot.com. She's worked with Angie's List and Newsbank. From Charleston, South Carolina, we have Maggie Greiner. Did I say that right?
You did. Thank you.
I see it written all the time because, you know, we work online and we see it written, but...
Yeah. Yeah. Now we're in person, live.
Thanks for joining us,
yes,
Maggie.
Thank you.
Next, we have a user experience designer who has worked on app and web experiences, including SpaceX and many more that cannot be mentioned, has previously worked with Kraft, and this person has a Kraft macaroni and cheese box that's currently on shelves that you can go. That's and great. If you see her at a designer DrupalCon conference, she will autograph this for you.
Providence. I carry them with me at all times.
Yes. It's the lock screen on her phone. From Providence, Rhode Island, Marissa Epstein. Welcome.
Howdy. Thanks, Mike. Thanks a bunch.
So I want some macaroni and cheese.
Well, I lied. I don't have them with me. I left them all in Rhode Island, but I will be sure to mail you some cheesy explosion.
Ooh. Is that what the box says?
Sure does.
Cheesy explosion. Yeah. That's cool.
Cheesy.
So our fourth guest as well today, we have a senior UX designer who's worked on MSNBC, SpaceX, and recently launched the thisoldhouse.com project, which I'm excited about being a DIY type guy myself. She has a Master of Fine Arts in Computer Art from the Rochester Institute of Technology. My favorite person from Buffalo, New York is Jen Witowski. Hey, Jen.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, Jen. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Why, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a little strange, don't you think, talking about design, because it's kind of an abstract concept a little bit.
It kind of is. I mean, to some people, yes.
Yeah?
But other people, no.
Maybe to you, Matt.
Maybe to you.
I guess I'm one of those people. Yeah. So, Jared, maybe if you don't mind kicking it off, as the creative director of Lullabot, what would you say you do here?
Yeah, it's not abstract to us, turns out. We do these things every day. And I also want to just put in that, like, if you ever get to see the macaroni and cheese box, I remember this from the first time I saw it, the first thought you'll have is, I didn't know cheese could do that. It's like, it's that impressive. It's a cheese explosion that, like, yeah, you have to see it.
Huh.
Anyway, what do? We basically help people figure out what the problems are for the actual people using the things that they're trying to put out there in the digital world. So we talk to those people, we help them talk to those people, we figure out ways to identify those things, and then we try to make visual things that represent what should solve the problems. And then we test it and find out if it does, and sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, and we iterate towards things that do. But our team tends to do more than just the figuring out the problems and talking to the people. We go all the way through and, like, figure out, well, how do you actually make that look like a thing that's your brand now and all that? So we kind of go all the way across the board. And
so what does that process look like? So you're working with companies and you're trying to take a more holistic approach. Is that correct? Or am I making that word up?
Maybe more holistic than some people do. But in terms of how the process looks, we often start out by talking to the people that we're actually going to be doing the work for. And figuring out with them who are these people that you're trying to make this thing for, and find ways of getting at those people. If you can't get at those people from the outset, then you end up finding ways to test what you'd make with those people once you make it. But I'm not sure if I'm speaking English here.
No, you're speaking English, but I want to kind of get a little bit deeper, right? So you're meeting with people, and then you're testing what you made. Like, how do you come up with ideas? Like, what's the creative process, if you will? I see all these articles on lullabot.com with, like, card sorting. I see sketches on our promos pages. I see all this stuff. And then I know, like, as a front-end developer, a lot of times I'll receive, like, Illustrator sketch files, sometimes Photoshop files. What's the process? And, like, I know there's some type of research that goes into this.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, so I'm going to hand the mic over, because Maggie wrote an article on that, and actually Marissa's just written an article as well on some of this process.
So all right, Maggie.
Well, you asked what our general process looks like, and I think three of us here started about 2 years ago. And in those 2 years, we've been working really hard to come up with a more research-informed process. So generally, that looks like starting out more with looking at business goals, user research, and market research, and then moving into taking like a basic brief of those concepts and moving into, like you said, sketching.
So let's start on the research. Like, when you do research, do you give a questionnaire to the stakeholders and then have them fill out stuff? Or, like, what's that process?
Clients, like Jared said, clients come to us with a set of problems that they're trying to solve, and they have an audience that we're trying to solve those problems for, and they also have a general market that they're working within that we're looking at as well. So what we do is we start by interviewing the stakeholders, understanding what those problems are and defining them, coming up with themes and patterns for what's really going on, what goals we have, and so forth. Once we start to get some things down on paper, then we kind of set up a research process, and that can look a lot of different ways, depending on the problems we're trying to solve, the people we're trying to talk to, and the market that we're in. So we really kind of ad lib depending on the exact client, sometimes we do a lot of with user research, for example, we want to talk to the audience. Figure out what they're thinking, what pain points they have, what experiences they're having with the current site, if it's a redesign. Sometimes we'll do more upfront research talking to them, or maybe we'll depending on the exact project, sometimes we will we'll go forward with creating and prototyping and creating ideas, and then we will come back and test those users and you know, use actual ideas that we come up with to figure out what they're thinking, as opposed to asking them up front. So it all kind of depends on the client, and that's how generally the research process goes, with the ultimate goal of informing, sketching, mock-ups, prototypes, basically the visual. But we're really working hard in the past 2 years to come up with a more research-informed visual that is as meaningful as it is beautiful.
Which I think kind of means a lot to somebody who thinks in ones and zeros. It's like, yeah, you know, everything is logical. It happens or it doesn't happen. And the design process might feel a little more hand-wavy, but when you back it with research and you are able to solve problems that you're trying to solve, it, I don't know, it feels more
logical.
Logical.
Yeah. So at what point does the client get what you're working on? You know, I know that a lot of, like Marissa has done work with like sketching and pencils. She walked us through some stuff earlier all together. And at what point does the client get to see that?
At what point does the client get to see the sketches?
Yeah, do they see the sketches, or do the sketches go to wireframes and then they see it? Or do we do full-fledged mock-ups in Photoshop or Illustrator?
Yeah, I'd love to know what others think on this, but yes. I mean, it just totally depends. Like,
maybe let's
yes,
give someone else.
Yes, all of it. It totally depends on the project. Yeah.
So give us some examples. When would you say send the sketches back versus when would you send like the fully complete Photoshop mock-ups back?
Well, I think it's a combination of the scope that we have to work with and the comfort level of the client. You know, usually you can get a pretty quick sense of how high fidelity we need to have for them to understand what we're working with, and that's always my favorite luxury. We recently worked on a project where they were very excited to see sketches and really understood the concept, and we were able to walk through, and it's not so much that is it sketches or is it comps. A lot of times it's more can we jump into sketches and show them the designs and the ideas that we're thinking of much more early to inform what we're going to do in the comps. Some clients, I think they need a little more of an understanding. They need to see it fleshed out a little more before they can make decisions and provide feedback, and so we don't always get that opportunity. But definitely sketching is a much faster way of illustrating a lot of our concepts and working through the design thinking that might be a little foreign, and so whenever we can get them in front of them, I think it's a really helpful opportunity.
And that can happen fairly quickly. Jen, I've heard stories of you drawing on windows with a dry erase marker and, you know,
yes.
starting to solve problems with clients right away.
So a lot of times, we like to start off a project doing an on-site with clients where we workshop with them. Where we can get information very quickly with them and work together with them to define goals and start the problem-solving process. A lot of times during this workshop is where we start our sketching, and that's where clients are either sitting right next to us as we start sketching out ideas on paper, or for MSNBC, it was Windows because we didn't have any dry erase boards in the room.
Not Microsoft.
Yeah.
Purdy Rockefeller Center had some Windows, and they just decided to, you know. Yeah.
But, you know, it's the idea of getting those ideas in front of them as soon as possible to get initial feedback so we know where we have to iterate, you know, what ideas that they're going to, you know, that they want to move forward with and what ideas they want us to kind of refine as we start moving forward in the process. So
how does sketching and everything work with distributed company? You know, like, I mean, obviously you're sketching here. It's really, do you guys like mail it over to like Jared or something like that?
I think they send a postcard or a carrier pigeon or something.
But seriously, everyone though, mails me sketches once a week, and I evaluate those sketches and then mail them back with notes.
That's kind of what I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, but seriously though, it's got to be.
It's way more sophisticated than that.
Do you do a happy face and a sad face?
Yeah. You're doing very visual work, though, in separate locations, and that's not always an easy thing to do.
Yeah, we do. So Marissa and I just worked on some stuff with Harvard recently where we did a live sketching session while I was actually on the road, and we do this all the time. We sketch some ideas. We share them back and forth. If we're all at our locations where we normally work, we have these things called IPvo cams, and we can maybe add a link to the post to this podcast.
What is that?
An IPvo cam is a document camera. It's like a webcam that you can buy. I think it costs $60-$70 on Amazon. They sell a document stand with it, and you can just set it up as your webcam. But it works really well if you want to just jump on a Google Hangout or Skype or whatever.
And say, here, look what I'm thinking here.
What's that?
And you can say, hey, look what I'm thinking here.
Yeah, and you can literally be live sketching with pencil and paper.
Oh, wow.
And so we do a lot of what we do with pencil and paper, and I think there's a big advantage to that. But to get more practical, Marissa and I were working on ideas for how to solve this IA issue with, like, how you move through all these different sites that were all part of this university.
What is IA?
Oh, sorry. Information architecture. I'm not supposed to use acronyms without explaining them when I'm doing these kinds of things. Information architecture. So people need to be able to move through all these different websites that are all part of a university. But they need to understand the site that they're actually on right now and not be overwhelmed with a million links all over the page and, you know, where am I? How do I get to where I want to go? Or I landed here, but I don't think this is actually the school that I'm supposed to be in. What I want is this thing. And so we started doing sketching sessions. We went back and forth because I wasn't in my main office. I didn't have my IPvo cam, so we used Envision App Live Shares.
Okay.
And we talked it through together. And then we popped those photos of sketches, like from our smartphones, into an Envision app project. And we actually shared those sketches, those pencil on paper sketches, with the client. And that began the process. We talked through those sketches with the client. And then those sketches turned into something more like what digital wireframes, like what people are maybe more familiar with wireframes looking like. But I kind of... I hate to use this term because it makes this part of design sound really aesthetic, but it's almost like, you know how when you're trying to paint one of the rooms of your house and you go to Home Depot and you get like the paint swatches and you bring them home, they cost nothing almost, or actually.
Wow.
Sketches do cost a little bit, but it's like they're like the paint swatches, where digital wireframes are more like the sample paint. It's like, okay, we think this is the way to go, but we want to like spend a little bit to like flesh this out a little bit more, make sure the actual content fits in this, that these words fit in the menu, you know. And so digital wireframes are kind of like the sample paint, where it's buying the 5-gallon bucket is the, you know, building the thing.
Sure. So. Sure. I like that. That's a good metaphor. So you mentioned Envision App, so that's one of the tools you use, and that's a I don't know. I've seen it before because I've seen comps. When I as a developer, I get to the website and they're asking us to build out a particular part of it. And I'm sure you too, Mike, as a front end developer, you probably see these more than I do.
All the time.
Yeah. So Envision App is kind of a way to share designs and comps with teams, and they're kind of interactive too, right? You can click on a piece.
I think ostensibly it was created as a prototyping tool, like for static, like building prototypes out of static assets. For like app designers and whatnot, but it's really a sort of a visual collaboration tool.
Are there any other tools that any of you use that think that you know, that are important to being a designer on a distributed team?
Microsoft Paint.
Do you use Paint? I mean, why not, right?
I should note that when he was talking about PSDs earlier, an interesting tidbit about Lullabot is our current design team, we have actually never used Photoshop as a design team, with the exception of one time when we had a client that already had a whole giant library of assets that they had produced that were all Photoshop files.
One of our first Lullabot clients, they did the design, and we had Photoshop documents. And to try and limit scope creep, we tried to check in these huge Photoshop documents into the Git repo. Oh. That didn't work so well.
Yeah. Photoshop files.
Pro tip, yeah.
Yeah, binary files in Git.
Not so much, yeah.
Yeah, but we do have a lot of clients that have like internal design teams that we work alongside, and so that's when we find ourselves using Photoshop sometimes.
And you've also, Jared, I've seen you work alongside the client's design team. Like, they have a separate design team contract, and Lullabot doing the implementation.
We do
might
advising
have...
where we're sort of essentially a consultant helping make sure that the design team that the client works with is doing, you know, has a process that actually is going to work for responsive design, or whether sometimes we're essentially the catalyst to make sure that the engineering team and the design team is working really well together. So we've done a number of different kinds of things. We we partner with our clients to make sure that projects go well.
So, Jen, when you actually decide you wanted to mock something up and we're not using Photoshop, what do you use?
Well, right now I try and use Sketch.
Okay, so what's Sketch?
Sketch is it's kind of like the new kid on the block when it comes to when it comes to applications for interface design. So the idea is like Photoshop's been out there for a while. Traditionally, web designers use Photoshop, and then I felt like there was kind of this break off where there was like this rebel against Photoshop because everything tend to move more towards flat design. So the bevels and embosses and drop shadows kind of went away in web design. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't really need those anymore in Photoshop. So I feel like a lot of web designers went more towards Illustrator just because it was a lot quicker. It's a lot quicker to mock up interface design and even wireframing. It's a lot easier. So and then SketchUp recently came out. It's been like two years ago, I think.
And it's a Mac app, or what is SketchUp?
It's a Mac app right okay. now. I don't think they have any as of right now. I don't think they have any plans to develop for PC apps. Or
that's what those cool kids are doing. So
yeah. So, but it's nice because it was designed for interface design. So. It's basically Illustrator stripped down to the basic things that you would use all the time in Illustrator, and taking out all of the miscellaneous extra stuff that Illustrator does that you wouldn't use as an interface designer. So it's I work a lot quicker in Sketch than I do in Illustrator.
I'm not good at this, but when I think about Illustrator, I think about logo design because isn't that vectors and
yes.
And so web design with Illustrator is kind of the way to go. Sometimes, if it's not Sketch.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
What do you guys use to edit your like raster files, your bitmap files? I used to be a big fan of Fireworks, just because you could do both like some of the vector stuff and the bitmap stuff directly in there. And it was cool because you just had one thing. It didn't take a whole long time to load. And now Adobe discontinued it because they're bastards. Like, what do you use for that type of stuff?
Honestly, we do usually end up going back to Photoshop. I think that it has a lot more photo editing capabilities, and we can really fine-tune there, but then it becomes a matter of importing that into a vector tool that's a little easier to work with for the other pieces.
Plus, you can put Mike's dog in the picture, too, right? Like that's the point of Photoshop, isn't it?
I think that's what it's for, face swapping and things like that.
I've been doing a lot of face swapping on my iPhone. It's such a cool app.
So my last job, actually, we worked, our designer did a lot of print design, and we had a magazine that we published, and I got a lot of web comps that were actually used, built with InDesign, which sounds a little strange, but it was something that worked because that was something that she was used to. And that was pre-responsive web design, so that wasn't something that was ever considered. It was, you know, this is the pixel-perfect design, mm-hmm. and build it that way.
Yeah, I think it does also depend on just what a designer's comfortable in and fast in. And we've talked about this before as a group, and I'll kind of always shyly say, but I still do it so much faster in Illustrator.
Okay.
So Matt just said the word pixel-perfect, so, like, all right, that's going through my head. I'm a front-end developer. So I'm thinking, I'm going to bring up some of my pet peeves as a front-end developer for designers. I just lay it right out on the table, right?
All right, we'll have the chance to lay out all of Mike's grievances with the Lolobot design team coming up right after this.
It's going to be good.
Oh, just sit down right over there. Hey, you there?
Yes.
Hey, Mike. I'm here with Mike Herschel.
How are you doing?
Front-end developer at Lolobot. Hey, Mike.
Yes, sir.
So we'd like to take this promotional spot here to talk a little bit about the Lolobot podcast.
Yeah, the Lolobot podcast is a great bi-weekly podcast. We talk about general Drupal and web development news.
Hey, guess what, though? They probably already know about the Lolobot podcast, don't they?
How's that?
Because they're currently listening to it.
Bam!
Hey, one thing. I guess we could, if we're going to promote anything, maybe you should like and subscribe. Like,
Yeah.
Wait, that's what YouTube people say, though. So what I'm saying, give us a 5-star review on iTunes.
Absolutely. I was just going to mention that.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Lolobot podcast. We're talking with Lolobot's design team here in the beautiful Serenbe Inn at the Lolobot Designer and Developer Retreat in hot and muggy Georgia in the USA. So, as opposed to the Georgia and like the Caucasus Mountains in Asia, you know, because we have a worldwide audience, right?
I suppose, yeah, like the other Georgia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have this list, like a very long, like it's a scroll in front of me of like grievances that I have been like jotting down ever since I've been working with designers. But before we get into that, let's talk about the history of design at Lullabot, just because Jared has been here since the beginning of it. So initially, Lullabot was a training company, right?
Yes, and I love that transition. I have a whole bunch of things that I hate about you, but
yes,
first,
exactly.
Tell me a little about yourself and where you've been. I've been at Lullabot for over 6 years now. And when the first time I started working for Lullabot, Lullabot was actually a client of mine.
Ooh, Lullabot hired somebody to do design?
Yes, yeah, Lullabot actually needed some help with their own site, as well as some other stuff they were sort of thinking about doing. And one interesting tidbit, when I was hired at Lullabot, there was no intention of Lullabot actually providing design as a client service. At the time, we had this idea for turning our training company into a digital training company. Like, how could we move this online? And that was actually the reason I came to Lullabot. And Jeff Robbins, who obsessively buys up domain names, had the foresight to buy the domain name DrupalSchool.com and had decided that this was the perfect place for us to turn all of this training work that Lullabot had been doing and make it available to more people who couldn't actually, you know, show up in Boston one day for a workshop or something.
Had Lullabot been making DVDs at that point?
Yes.
Yeah.
Lullabot had a series of DVDs, and it was becoming cumbersome to keep. Turns out Drupal keeps releasing like new editions, and software seems to like not actually work exactly the same way 5 months later, even than when it was released. And so DVDs were just a really weird way of continuing to teach people because it was like the DVDs would become obsolete. So,
well, it was kind of the way to do it, though. I mean, that's been several years, and internet connections weren't that
great.
I
mean,
streaming video was okay.
You have to remember that this was a time where, like, Netflix was just beginning to think, huh, wonder if we could stop mailing these to people.
Well, their company name was Netflix, so I'm sure that was in the cards from the beginning. But, I mean, Netflix used to be the mail the DVD service, right? Yeah.
So I was hired to help create DrupalSchool.com. Turns out Dries Boitart, if I'm saying that correctly.
I think you're close. But Mike knows how to mispronounce names, so what would you say?
Buttert.
Okay. Buttert?
I don't think that's right.
Okay.
I would say like Bytart.
Bytart? Boitart?
Something. Hi, Dries.
It's close, yeah. Yeah. I will, you know, full disclosure, I actually have no Belgian roots, so I'm probably saying it wrong. But he like owns all the licensing for everything Drupal, and as we began thinking through this product and this project, we discovered that the way the trademark laws work, like Dries basically owns the name Drupal, and it would be inappropriate for us. Like, we'd probably end up in a war with Dries if we actually tried to open up Drupal School. Based
that was
on
never
the
our
trade...
goal, right? That
yeah,
was,
yeah. So we ended up coming up with a different name, but when I started Lullabot, it was to make what became Drupalize.me, and over time, it was actually in the middle of making that we began having clients asking about the work that we were doing, and asking if we could do some of that for them, and here we are years later.
Here you are with a team.
Yeah.
We're around the table with a design team.
Whoops.
Turns out you're pretty popular.
Right. So now I want to hear all of Mike's grievances.
So we're around this circular table right here, and I'm just about to flip it.
Yeah. You mentioned Pixel Perfect, and I do want to say, like, so I've had this opinion about that. I that's a phrase that's always bothered me.
Yeah.
And the thing that I've always thought about Pixel Perfect is it comes from an era that was so fixed that it's a little bit like a chef being adamant that you need to use exactly this many tablespoons of X ingredient regardless of how many you're making this for. And it's like, meaning this thing needs to be able to scale. So like, design is actually, even whether it's you're designing a meal or what, it's proportional. And so there are proportioning systems, so there's design intent that actually where the proportion is, like, there is an intent for the proportion. but it doesn't mean it's an exact number of pixels, because that actually varies. Does that make sense?
So when I'm in the kitchen with my mom and we're making her barbecue brisket and I'm making the barbecue sauce and I just start dumping things...
Yes.
Close enough. It's going to taste about right. But
yeah.
She gets a little upset because I don't actually measure much.
Right. Yeah. It's just most of our clients don't want Matt's homemade barbecue brisket for their homepage.
They should. It's really good.
It sounds good.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, like most clients are kind of over the whole pixel perfect type. What do you call it, a scenario. You know, I remember back in the day, like, actually, like, putting the image of the comp in front of the HTML, you know, adding some alpha transparency, and then kind of fixing stuff up. And honestly, to this day, I still kind of do that at certain breakpoints just to make sure I don't see anything, like, completely, like, that I screwed up. But there are a couple things that sometimes, you know, I end up kind of, you know, it kind of bothers me a little bit. So the first thing is, like, when you have a lot of one-off kind of, components, right? So a lot of people nowadays try to do component-based design where you'll have a component, it could be like a media component or anything really. And some of this gets into like atomic design, if you've heard of that, and other stuff where you'll have a style guide and you can just kind of stack these components or put them together and in a perfect world, they'll all fit. But there's been a lot of times where I have these components. I'm not picking on you guys, because it's mainly designers in general. They'll say, well, like, yeah, but you know, on this page, we want this maybe like, I don't know, 4 pixels bigger or something similar to that.
I'm not sure that's designers. Sometimes that's people who are in charge of making the website work.
Sometimes it's designers.
Yeah. Okay. So when you're talking about component-based design and things like that, so like there's a list, and that list will look like a list across your website. And sometimes you might combine a list with an image or something, and there are like recipes.
Yeah, absolutely. There'll be recipes, and there'll be like a certain number of variations, you know. And in a perfect world, you know, someone could just like take a set of markup, say, I want to move this into this page, and it's just going to look perfect, or I want to do this and this, and it'll look perfect. But like a lot of times, you end up like, I don't know, just kind of cluttering up your markup or cluttering up your style sheets and stuff with all these types of one-offs. And that for me is just like, it's not a pain point, but it's just like one of those things that bugs me. I don't really know what else to call it.
So deviations from the norm?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I'm hearing is you just want to do less work across the board.
Who doesn't? Yeah. That's
okay. I am a developer. Yeah.
This brings us back to what we were talking about last night, which is the relative importance of priorities. Because it all comes back to context. Like, usually when that's happening intentionally, when there's designer intent, it's because while this thing actually is designed to actually have this contextual priority within this page type, like on this page, this is happening, and this, therefore the headline of this needs to be larger on this page type than that page type. That's like when it's happening by intent. It's like the designer's actually thought through, like, well, this component actually should be a little different here, or it should be a little different here because it's coming right after this thing, and because the design of this component is to have this big bright blue background, that's actually going to like make it come up in the visual hierarchy when you put it in this context, and so we need to change it here. When it happens outside of that, I'd love to hear some of the other designers talk about this. It's actually, I think, due to like a tools and process problem and like time constraints where we're just not able to kind of keep track of all the things that change by small amounts, and developers are actually taking it as sort of designer bespoke like instruction, like, oh, weird, they have this thing 3 pixels taller in this mock as opposed to that mock. And a lot of times it's like, yeah, they didn't mean to.
I've got some of that.
It's really hard. Like, we've had a tools problem that has like facilitated that, where we just don't have good ways to save one thing and have it propagated across multiple files so that every designer can leverage one another's things and keep it the same everywhere, and that's slowly changing. Do others have thoughts about this, things that you found that are working?
Yeah, I definitely think that the first piece is just identifying the system and trying to have a style guide that you can work from. And I've done this a few times where I'll be working on design files and handing them over and explaining the intent, and I'll always add the disclaimer of, You'll probably find some inconsistent margins. You know, I expect you to find one stray hex color, but here is a file where I know everything is correct, and that is essentially our system that we'll be going by. And I think for us especially, we've done a lot of very big projects very quickly with all hands on deck, and I think that's where I've seen it happen especially is we might be working from something that isn't entirely approved, or we'll have a system that we feel good about, but we haven't built out pages to their completion, and we're all just, you know, running it full sprint. So I think it's very easy to get to that point and say, well, these are all really great pieces, but this is 10 pixels off here and 10 pixels off. And I mean, at least for me, I'm not super excited about going back through those files and cleaning up all those tiny pieces when you're going to just be creating a CSS system anyway. So I'd much rather say, if you find something crazy, ask me. And I think the Lullabot developers have been great about that. You know.
So what I'm hearing is that communication is important, right?
Absolutely.
Because sometimes it's done on purpose. Like, this headline needs to be a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's, yeah, I screwed up, sorry.
I think the biggest thing is setting intent with some sort of system and saying, here's our style guide, and you'll notice here's two headlines in there, and then you know that they're changing. And, you know, I think, like I said, I do think it's a great thing to just check in before you build, you know, 8 different versions of the padding to just say, hey, was this intentional?
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. It makes me feel better. Thank you.
Plus, if Mike, you know, has to do a whole lot of work, they know that makes him upset, so...
It does not.
I'll add to that. Like, I do think it's mostly a communication problem. It's also like an agency model problem, because the reason, like, the cause, and this is something that I feel keenly all the time. Most agencies try to keep things separated between design and development, and so I want to be able to have, like, you know, Jen, Marissa, Maggie, they're awesome. I want to be able to sell them to a new client. So I want to be able to move them on to another project, when you really need to be able to have that at least a designer who worked on it still available to work with the developers to talk through those things, because it's so much easier to actually one by one have those conversations. But that's a resourcing challenge and an engagement design challenge. And at Lullabot, we've actually just been very intentional about trying to maintain some level, and that's through pain. It's through times where we didn't do that, where we're, you know, because honestly, like, the whole handoff scenario is a little bit of an illusion, because that puts this incentive on designers to spend inordinate amounts of time, like, double checking every last little detail, that you could actually spend way less time having sort of a dev support phase in a project, where you have a part-time designer that's still available to work with those developers.
So for clarity, like, if Lullabot signed a big contract with Acme, and we're going to build anvils or their anvil mm-hmm. website,
yeah,
right?
The Acme Wiley will run from us.
Exactly, right? So maybe the first step's going to be some of you folks are going to be in and talking with them about mm-hmm. what their website needs to do, and there might be some research involved and user personas and that kind of thing. And then there's aesthetic design, and everything gets laid out, and there are comps that exist. But at that point, design is truly almost finished, right? Like, these are the designs, this is how it works, and there's this theoretical handoff. But what you're saying is that really doesn't end up.
Yeah, it turns out nobody wants designs, they want a website.
Sure.
And so in the end, that thing has to actually reflect the designs, and it's what we've found, and maybe this will be different 10 years from now than it is right now, but right now, with the tools we have and the way that we make digital products, it's actually less expensive for everyone to keep some design availability through development, to have more of an overlap. It's not, there's an, like, some agencies in, even we at one point experimented this on a project where we're like, it's going to be this core team and it's going to be that way through the whole thing, where that's actually tends to be a little expensive. And so
you're saying because there are too many design resources at the end, and
yeah, because really you actually don't need a full-time, like, depending on the scale of the project, you may not need a full-time person through the end. But again, it's a resourcing challenge for agencies, but you need to just acknowledge that the designers and the developers need to be working together on the implementation. And so at least some kind of a part-time capacity is helpful.
So another pet peeve that I have is something that Marissa is awesome at. I'm working with Marissa on a project right now, and she's designing these components. And whenever she designs these components, before she even shows them to the stakeholders, she'll say, "Hey, Mike, how does this look? Is anything like really difficult or really screwy? And I'll say, no, it's all good. And thank you for that, because there are so many times where, you know, there's a component that might be super easy to do one way, but it's designed another way that's not necessarily, it's equal, but it's not necessarily better. And, but it adds development hours. So that's something that I think Lullabot does really well with. I think we're very good communicators as a whole. And thanks for that, Marissa.
You are super welcome. Yeah, I was thinking that as Jared was explaining having a designer stay on. I think it works both ways, to have a developer within that design process and raising any flags before we get too far and too invested into the design.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. So how does, when we're working with all these static resources like Illustrator, Sketch, and stuff like that, do we do different comps per viewport size? How does that work?
Yeah, typically within an app like Sketch or Illustrator, you can create multiple artboards and look at the same component across different sizes. And so it depends on the project. A lot of times what I'll do is try to design mobile and desktop and then sort of walk through the in-between wasteland, so to speak, with the developer.
I've been on projects that have the three breakpoints, but what happens in between these three things?
Yeah.
you just display none it.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
I think it's question marks and then profit, yeah. I think.
Between 900 and 961 pixels, as the website is gorgeous.
Yeah. Well, at a certain point,
no one zooms.
We're just wasting time polishing,
zoom,
too, you know?
Yeah.
It's, oh, shh. No. Don't worry about that.
Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, right. I think it depends, but I found that sometimes you can just over-polish and you're getting stuck in the static comps worrying about this size, this size, this size. And I really love when you have the ability to collaborate with a developer and say, show me. You know, a developer asks me, where's the breakpoint? And I say, let's find out, you know, and show me where it breaks. That's where it breaks. And then we can kind of go from there as far as tablet.
And something I've heard Jared explain is like the breakpoint, where technically it's like this is where the mobile design CSS might pick in, but it's where the design actually breaks.
The origin of that term is the point at which something breaks.
Sure.
Like, it's a breakpoint. And the problem is it's not like page level, site level, holistic. So Jen and I, Jen maybe can talk a little bit more about this, but in a project that we recently did for thisoldhouse.com, because the entire project was how big of an improvement could we make in a very short period of time for a whole new ownership group and basically a new direction for the brand. We actually came up with a strategy that ended up working pretty well, which was we would design for the extremes. And then we would keep on a designer to work with the developers for everything in between, so that we would only address the points at which things break, as opposed to saying, like, we're going to give you a tablet breakpoint or something like that. And Lullabot cares about that model enough that I'm willing to sell myself in as that support designer at times when it's just, like, resourcing-wise, it's just not even possible, because we just believe that, like, the developers and the designers are going to need to work together for that stuff.
That's a really good point. Something that bugs me, and I see a lot of other front-end developers doing this, is where they set, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 breakpoints for the actual, you know, website. But the thing is, different pages break at different places, you know? There are certain times where breakpoints will only need to affect one page and will not affect another page. And they might be maybe on the same pixel or rem value, but they might be breaking for a different reason. You know, the navigation might be collapsing at, you know, 600 pixels on this page for this, but something else might be going on at 600 pixels for this. Should they be the same breakpoint or not? I honestly, like, my personal thing is I create two SAS variables for that. So you can change one without changing the other. And that's something to me that I think is, you know, could be a more popular thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think too, with a past project that I worked on working with breakpoints, we had a similar issue where, like, the navigation would break at, we found out the navigation would break at this point, but 20 pixels later, a different component broke at another breakpoint. And that at that point, we kind of looked at it and was like, how can we redesign this component or move things around this component so they could at least share a similar breakpoint and we don't have that problem of having a lot of breakpoints when it comes to the design. So,
how early does that come into the process, Maggie? Do you just think about
responsive
stuff when we get to the research process? I mean, is there a standard set of situations that we need to handle from the beginning, or how does that work?
Yeah, I think it's different with every project, but we definitely try to consider responsive as early as possible. You know, when we're thinking about those business goals and the audience and everything, we're asking about device usage, and we're trying to figure out, you know, how that plays in. And then, like Jared said, it's all about priorities, and we're taking that information and then figuring out what the responsive strategy is from there.
So where do you start? Do you do mobile first or do you do desktop first design?
I think Marissa kind of touched on it, but I think as a team, we're usually our general strategy, correct me if I'm wrong, or at least what I've learned a lot in the past 2 years that I see a lot of value in is sketching or wireframing them both at the same time. Like Jared said, both extremes, so desktop and mobile at the same time. So that just is extremely helpful for, you know, I think it can be more powerful than, you know, the trendy mobile first term a lot of the times, because you're trying to solve a problem and you sketch them both at the same time and you're thinking about how they both could impact each other, and maybe a mobile idea then informs a desktop idea or vice versa. So they kind of they pair well together.
How do you work with like complex interactions? Like if you have some crazy scrolling interaction or some crazy fly-ins doing something, how do you work with that within your tools? And why are you guys laughing at me?
That's actually a really interesting question, and that's something that I've seen websites start to do more and more.
I've worked on several. Sci-Fi. Yeah.
Sci-Fi.com has lots of different interesting scroll interactions as you cruise down the page, and what does it do?
Sci-Fi.com is kind of complex. Like as you scroll, different elements are moving around. So there's a whole bunch of stuff bound to the scroll events, and opacity's changing. Things are translating. Divs are expanding, revealing advertisements, and there's a lot that went into that in addition to the design. But there's a lot of like performance type stuff that goes into that. How do you relay these ideas to your front end developers?
It's a great question. We are really excited about this topic right now, and you know, I think it's something we can we're really passionate about improving. So prototyping is what we're talking about right now. Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways to prototype, and I feel like we've tried a lot of them. Our probably like, what's the word, mainstay or our go-to is InVision. So we just link static comps together, but we're limited to, we're limited by the functionality that InVision brings to the table. You know, it brings a lot to the table, but like you were describing, you know, crazy situations, very crazy situations. And in that case, we've recently gone a step further to start dabbling with animated GIFs. And that's
not GIFs, but GIFs.
Yeah. I thought you meant GIFs.
Yeah.
Is it really GIFs? Or are you guys? I'm extremely gullible, so.
It's whichever one you want.
Thank you.
No, it's not giraffic. It's graphic.
Just ask the person who made the file format. Like the inventor of the file format says that it's GIF.
He should know.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. What does he know?
What does he know? Like, we could just use PNGs and then nobody can complain about it because PNG or ping, it's all okay too. But you're saying you're using animated images to be able to kind of communicate what you're thinking.
Right. So you asked about tools earlier. recently I played around with using ScreenFlow. I believe the InVision team, the InVision app team, uses ScreenFlow to create their animated GIFs. And so I played around with that recently, and it's really cool because if you have something more complex, you can basically create a movie file, and you can use an application like ScreenFlow that has no limits in terms of what type of sort of scenario you want to play out, whereas, you know, other applications may be a little bit faster, but it's just not as much creative flexibility. So it just depends.
So Mike said the magic word that kind of brings me to my next topic. He's looking at me strange. So you guys might lay out a gorgeous design that's absolutely useful and solves problems for the customer, but the customer also then has to put ads on the website. Because as it turns out, commercial websites are kind of important to our jobs, but as well as the client. Like, selling ads is a mainstay of their business. Is that another design problem you have to have? And maybe there's some other interesting situations you have to figure out as far as adding advertisements to the website, especially the really annoying ones that have, like, the dancing silhouettes or the flyouts or the hijacking scroll interactions
So we recently worked on a project where we had to take into account advertising. And I think the big thing, we knew that early on, so we kind of designed around the advertising, and then we actually started designing the advertising. So one of the things that we proposed to them is doing like a parallax advertisement when you scroll down. It would have with a parallax immersive, I think the name of it is.
So is that when you scroll down, it like totally scrolls up and then the ad totally takes over until you keep scrolling? Or that was something that I saw recently and I thought, wow, that's really...
It wasn't the whole screen.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it was just like a bar across.
Just a portion of it, okay.
But I think, too, it's working with their ad team to figure out, okay, strategically, where do the ads have to be placed, and finding a design system that places them in a way on the page that... isn't very intrusive to the design itself. So,
sure, but they sell these ads to people who want their ads to be seen. So
yeah,
there's kind of a trade-off.
Yeah, there is. But at the same time, it's figuring out like ad spots basically. So in the design itself. So obviously, a lot of advertisers want their ads above the fold.
Is that a thing, above the fold? I mean, my cell phone doesn't fold. My computer doesn't. How does that work?
Your computer definitely folds.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're using a laptop there. Your computer folds. That's still very much a thing, but it has to do with, like, priority.
Sure.
Like, what's the stuff that even if somebody doesn't scroll, they're going to see? And people still really care about that.
To the young people who have never read a newspaper, above the fold referred to the content that was visible
before you unfolded
the newspaper up and the newspaper unfolded,
right?
The top half of the newspaper.
That's still, it's essentially the same concept within anything digital, whether it's an app or whether it's the web.
Above the scroll?
Yeah, above the scroll. There you go. Which takes us way back to like scrolls. It's all coming back. One of the things I want to say is that, like, turns out, like, so I've worked on a number of projects where ads were a big part of the revenue model for the client. And it turns out, like, our clients actually usually feel the same way about advertising in our design processes as we do. They want it to actually be relevant. They want the ads to somehow be useful. It's a challenge for them as it is for us. It's also seemingly a race to the bottom. Like, for a lot of, like, we live in a world where actually the return on investment for advertising, as well as the return that the clients are getting for selling them, is getting lower and lower. And so it's a real challenge. It's like, it's a very big deal. And it can be like a dark part of the world that we live in, like, where clients have to figure out a way to still maintain the revenues that they have. And so that's one of the things that as design teams that we do is actually figure out what the business needs are, not just the user needs, and at times try to come up with creative solutions on both sides of that. Like, what are ways that we could actually create more valuable ways for your sponsors to be promoting themselves within the content? And in the project that Jen was referencing, we did some of that. We were sort of forecasting out a little further than what could be there at launch of where they could go, ways that they could make it so that, for example, a sponsor of a given piece of content could end up having like maps regionally connected to their stores that would come with the printable version because this particular site had an older audience that would print hit the print thing a lot.
That's a thing, like printing out a website?
Yes, it is, especially on how-to material online.
You got to remember, that's how they share their comps.
Right.
So are print style sheets a thing? Like, Mike, when you go to a front-end, as a front-end developer, is that something you end up thinking about on projects?
Actually, that's like a ticket that I'm currently working on right now with this project with Marissa. So that's not something that you typically work on. That's not a typical thing, but like for certain use cases, that's very important depending on your, you know, what the use of the website is. And something that's really cool, if people don't know, as a front-end developer, there's a little toggle within Chrome Developer Tools where you can toggle on the print style sheet so you can develop with that, which is kind of a nice little tidbit for people that don't know that.
I think it definitely also depends on the audience. So we're dealing with an older audience and, you know, very much considering the personas that are using the site, and for something that's a little more library-oriented, document-oriented, elderly-oriented, there is a lot of printing, and we have to consider all the styles twice.
So, Jen, we've talked about This Old House. Is thisoldhouse.com, is that the website that we've worked on?
Correct.
That's cool.
Yeah, I know, isn't it?
Right? Norm and Kevin, I
grew up with the brand. So my dad watched the TV show, and my mom got the magazine. I've been getting the magazine ever since I moved out of my house.
I've always loved Norm Abrams' R's. Like, that was something that was fascinating to me growing up in Colorado. It's like, really, awesome. People talk like that? Marissa, if you're in Rhode Island now, that's a thing, right?
Right.
You mean Marissa?
Marissa? So Jen, did your dovetail skills improve when you were working on your
unfortunately, I'm not very handy like that. Okay. I have a family that is. Just never... all the projects looked really interesting, though. There was a outdoor game. It was kind of like horseshoes, build-it-yourself horseshoes. And I was like, I could do this.
Nice.
But I didn't.
Well, that means you did a very good job on the design. Yeah, it looked very approachable and, you know, brought you in. So that's a project that we work primarily design with, right?
Yes. It was design and strategy.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
Was it a Drupal site? It was a Drupal site. Cool. I'm seeing Jared nod, which doesn't work very well on a podcast.
Well, I'm not on a microphone.
Oh, okay.
It was definitely a fun project to work on. It was a very quick timeline, and I think that everybody who was involved did an awesome job. It looks gorgeous, and I know that there's still more that, you know, they plan on doing with the site. So it'll be exciting to see how it evolves in the next couple of years. And, you know, what type of new features and ideas that they want to incorporate into the site. So,
Maggie, do you have any final thoughts? Anything that... yeah, exactly. I don't know.
The customary killing of one of the guests.
Exactly. We're actually sitting in a dunk tank.
Maggie, do you have any final thoughts or anything that you find interesting in the design process that most people might not know anything about?
I guess I'd just like to say that I'm honored to be here with this team, and I've learned so much in the past couple of years. And you know, you say, what do I find interesting about the design process? And that whole perspective that I have has changed in the past 2 years, thanks to these great designers that I work with. And you know, I think we all learn from each other every day, and we've been, and we get these retreats to spend with each other. So I'm trying to have a romantic final thought here. Aww. Since you're asking for final thoughts. Maybe we need a.
That's very sweet.
Thanks, Maggie.
I love you guys.
Marissa, are we going to go to Cheers and have a beer? And no.
Hey, I'm not from Boston.
Oh, okay.
Just because I get to listen to it all day. to echo that, I think absolutely we all push each other in a way that is amazing. And even, you know, especially just thinking about this old housework, I'm very proud of the work that we do. I think we push each other really far. And I love something that Jared has said to us once, is that he has one of each designer, and I think we all bring each other bring something else to the table for each other. Where you know, we've been talking about organization and aesthetic and research and the process with collaborating with development and all these different pieces. And I think that everybody is constantly learning from each other, myself included. It's very humbling, and it's a great honor.
Jen Witowski, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I'm going to echo all that.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely definitely learned a lot from this team so far. The one thing that I really love about this team is everybody is always flexible and they're always open to learning. So, you know, if somebody brings a new tool to the table or a new idea to improve a process, we're always open to try it out on the next project to see how it goes and iterate or, you know, make changes to it based on, you know, the experience that we had. So,
Jared Ponchot, creative director. We're sitting around the table with a team of designers that's a part of Lolabot. I think it's often, I mean, especially to podcast listeners who might come from the Drupal community, it's Lolabot does design, and we do a pretty cool job of it, if I do say so myself. Mm-hmm. It's cool how that's actually grown over the last couple of years.
One thing I'll say is that because our foundations is an engineering company, I actually think that it's an interesting place to be a design team. And one of the really neat things that we as a design team learn and that we as Lolabot bring as a value is that we actually, I feel like, are really good at learning how to bring teams together. And notice I didn't say we know everything about how to do this, but we're really good about learning all the time. And so I think we teach our clients how to learn with us. And this team, like, that I have, that I get to work with, like, I hired them, but I've learned a ton from them, and I get to learn all the time from what we do. And I think that Lolabot has like a really cool learning culture that was there from the beginning because we started as an education company.
So maybe I work for Acme Company and I need a new Anvil website.
Yeah.
We should reach out, right? Because
right,
Lolabot,
totally,
soup
totally
to nuts.
Reach out, because we love our clients, like, and we've done a lot of really cool things, and we've learned a lot, and we've also, like, gotten good at learning with our clients.
So maybe Lolabot has something more to offer than just Drupal expertise. We can build you to that awesome Drupal 8 website, but it's going to look great and work great, too.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Until Mike gets a hold of it.
God help us all.
And then it's going to be really fast, but, you know.
Yes.
Thanks, guys.
Ta-da.
It's kind of awkward when you're sticking something like this in my face.